introduction, Sebastian. Thank you for this opportunity, and thank you all for being here. So, as Sebastian mentioned, I'll be telling you about my work on understanding holography for finite space-time regions, a la ADS-CFT, or an extrapolation thereof. This is based on these articles. A lot of it has to do with this TT-bar deformation in the context of two-dimensional holographic conformal field theories. But there's also some work on more general settings and even four-dimensional generalization of these ideas. So to get started, what do we usually say that the holographic duality is? Well, it's duality between gravity in Andrew de Sitter space of some number of dimensions and a conformal field theory, a non-gravitational conformal field theory living in one lower dimension, seen as the boundary of this Andrew de Sitter space, the asymptotic boundary in particular. And the fact that this is an asymptotic boundary is important in making sense of the fact that this is a non-gravitational conformal field theory. So the asymptotic boundary conditions are such that this is really just a flat space, the boundary, I mean, of one lower dimension. And the asymptotic symmetry group, that is the diffeomorphisms of this manifold, modulo those that reduce to identity at infinity, become the conformal isometries of this boundary. So it's very natural to put a conformal field theory on it. Now, what I'll be talking about is what happens when this boundary is no longer asymptotic. And there, we no longer get to completely insulate the boundary theory from the presence of at least a background gravitational field. And so in much of what follows, I will be considering quantum field theories living on, say, an arbitrary background metric, which is to be seen as the metric induced on the boundary in which this tentative dual theory lives. But that's in a few slides. So the I'm using radius in a vague sense, but usually in Andrew de Sitter space, in coordinates that people usually like, you can identify the asymptotic boundary as the surface of infinite radius, so it's the radial coordinate. More generally, I just mean some function whose level set defines this boundary. And once you're at finite radius, so to speak, it's no longer a special place, and that will matter. More follows. But the conventional holographic dictionary, which is not going to be modified that much, tells us to identify or associate to the pairs of vacuum expectation values of singlet operators of this conformal field theory and sources of said operators the momenta and field values on that boundary surface. So the asymptotic field value is the source for a certain operator, and the expectation value of that operator, like an expectation value, is the momentum conjugate to it. So this notion of a radial phase space associated with the Pascal theory with this boundary is something that will be used again and again. The bulk dynamics sort of is identified with the renormalization group flow of the theory on the boundary. And that's in keeping with interpreting this radial direction that we just discussed as the energy scale. And there's this mnemonic, which I'll try to make sense of, that GR is roughly RG because of inversion symmetry. And the scaling dimensions of operators on the boundary are related to masses of bulk fields in the following way. And then, there's several other entries in this dictionary, but we won't be needing more than these.
Just to follow up on the question that was asked.
Sure.
Am I basically thinking of going away from Andrew de Sitter, but just a more fully Fourier frame?
The solution will still have negative cosmological constant in what follows, but the brain or the boundary on which the theory lives is no longer held fixed, so to speak, that there's nothing that allows you to do that anymore. Of course, you're fixing Dirichlet boundary conditions there, but that's not to say that there's an invariant way of specifying it some coordinate value. So there's...
Starting with a D3 plane in flat space and going to the near horizon, but then getting ADS, but now you're going away, back to the sort of brain.
Well, sort of. I mean, it's more like saying that you're trying to untake the near horizon limit in a weird way. Yeah, but yeah, it's along those lines, although not completely. I mean, there's more to do to understand to rediscover the theory of D3 brains, not just a low energy effective field theory, but that's sort of the spirit of it. But again, going back to what this nice picture is that I'd like everyone to think about is that there's an ultraviolet conformal or quantum field theory and an infrared one. There's a renormalization group flow connecting them. But in the duality, you think of this renormalization group flow as essentially telling you that there's a theory of general relativity coupled to matter in one higher dimension. And that the information in the normalization group flow is essentially encoded in these the equations of motion of this dual theory. So one gravity motivation to want to understand finite boundaries is that there's an opportunity to leverage effective field theory. What I mean by that is, so Einstein essentially told us that general relativity in four dimensions is the unique theory of a dynamical metric field. There's two derivatives in the Lagrangian. Lovelock generalized this to higher dimensions, where he found a class of, in addition to general relativity, a class of quasi-topological theories, which propagate the same number of degrees of freedom. However, since we're dealing with the phase space associated with these finite boundaries, what ends up happening is that if one tries to stay on the same phase space, these quasi-topological theories give rise to multi-valued Hamiltonian flows. For simplicity, we'd like to start off by saying that, well, the renormalization group flow we're studying is single-valued, say. That restriction, along with the assumption that we're dealing with the same phase space, static general relativity, says that the only possible theory, which is covariant, local, that propagates the right number of degrees of freedom on this phase space is general relativity, and the dynamics are dictated by Einstein's equations. I'll explain in detail how this works in a moment, but the hope is to leverage this. So what I mean is that if one could get on top of just this phase space, the manifestation of diffeomorphism invariance, not just of this finite radius brain, but also of the ambient space-time in which it lives, then we're guaranteed that the only dynamics that's compatible with this is that which is given by the Einstein equations. Now, of course, there's also a field theory motivation for considering holography at finite radius, which is that we would like to understand, say, the Wilsonian version of the holographic renormalization group. So Wilson's renormalization group, we understand how to relate or how to think about effective field theories all living on space of couplings or the space of theories that have flows between each other. And we have organizational principles such as symmetries, gauge invariance, field content, and we just need to know where the fixed points are. And this is a very powerful way of understanding the normalization group, understanding how quantum field theories relate to each other. In this situation, what happens is that the role of the cutoff in Wilson's normalization group is played by this radial coordinate, bug. So taking the radial coordinate to infinity is like what takes us to the ultraviolet regime of the dual quantum field theory. But putting a sharp radial cutoff, that's where there was a little bit of missing work until recently. because people didn't really understand how to implement this regulator, this cutoff scheme on the side of the quantum field theory. But as I will discuss, in certain settings, we know how to do that. And we can interpret the radial development now as giving us the interpolating theories along an RG flow, each of which live on successive constant radius hypersurfaces. Okay, so going back to what I was talking about before, if we were to just ask in general relativity, well, what are the rules that take us from some codimension one hypersurface to the next codimension one hypersurface? Well, the answer is certain components of the Einstein equations, which are to be interpreted as constraints that essentially compose the total Hamiltonian of the system. It's a diffeomorphism invariant theory, which means that these constraints, modulo surface terms, are just, that this Hamiltonian modulo surface terms vanishes, and that's what I meant when I said that these constraints compose the Hamiltonian, and they have the interpretation of either generating normal or tangential deformations along these embedded hypersurfaces. Now, given these functions, now thought of as functions on the phase space I was mentioning before, through their Poisson brackets, we can get the rest of the Einstein equations as well. So obtaining these constraints on this phase space is essentially the same as obtaining the nonlinear Einstein equations in the emergent bulk. And this is, again, one of the reasons why going to finite radius, no longer being allowed to have a fixed asymptotic boundary, can be useful for us, because we in principle would like to discover this. So let's contrast this picture with a very similar looking one, which is of the so-called local renormalization group. Now, if we want equations of motion in gravitational theory to stand in for renormalization group flow equations, we can't be thinking of constant couplings evolving with respect to some constant scale. Instead, we should be thinking of turning on arbitrary sources for all composite operators and performing a kind of local coarse graining where we rescale the cutoff in a space-dependent manner. And this is Osborne's idea of the local renormalization group. Usually, what we can cast the Kalman-Simancic equation as is a kind of anomalous word identity that's telling us how the generating function under such a local change of scale responds. And it does so through the anomaly and through beta functions, which are essentially the scale derivative of these sources. Now, sources, given their scale dependence, naturally live in one higher dimension. And, you know, this I've of course drawn these two pictures to look similar, but the idea now would be to try to understand what sort of renormalization group flow, or what operator that triggers the right kind of renormalization group flow, will make these two pictures identical. And in the context of two-dimensional holographic large C conformal field theories, dual to general relativity in ADS3, the answer is the so-called TT-bar deformation. Before describing how this works in the holographic context, I'll just describe what this operator is, what it does. So it's a composite operator built of the stress tensor. In complex coordinates, you can write it as just a product of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic stress tensor components. But more covariantly, this is the form it takes. This colons here denote the normal ordering. What Zamolodchikov proved was that the expectation value of this operator on flat space in any translation invariant state factorizes as follows. This looks very much like large N factorization, or large C factorization rather, but it's in fact a little bit more general. And what I mean by deforming a conformal field theory by it is basically described in this equation that I look at a family of quantum field theories that I sort of, if I took a derivative along the parameter, generating this one parameter family, that I have this TT bar operator appearing on the right-hand side. So perturbatively in this deformation parameter, I would expect that the CFT generating function gets corrected to first order by just one power of TT bar. Again, I've used the factorization property in writing it, and then there's higher powers and so on. And as I mentioned before, this respects translation inverse or Poincaré invariance in two dimensions. So stress tensor conservation is unaffected by this deformation. However, conformal invariance is obviously broken. And that's what this equation is telling us. Now,
and sorry, this is quite a natural thing to do because it's irrelevant.
Yes, that's true.
Right.
Yeah. It is indeed a natural, and it's in fact somewhat of a miracle that we can even make sense of this seemingly backwards RG flow. In general, people can track what happens to various physical observables along this flow, and that's how we know that it makes sense to try to do this. But no one really knows what the real reason is. In holographic theories, in sort of narrow context of large scale holographic theories, I will give an argument later for why you can do this. But it is true that this is an irrelevant operator, and usually deforming by an irrelevant operator causes a lot of trouble. But on the other hand, if we're thinking from the perspective of trying to replicate some kind of Wilsonian RG scheme, usually you would implement the cutoff by introducing an infinite series of irrelevant operators. So usually you'd modify the kinetic term, say, like how Polchinski does it, by some higher derivative cutoff. That's equivalent to saying that I'm just adding this infinite series of increasingly irrelevant operators. And the scale associated to these irrelevant operators is what I treat as the cutoff. So I'm only allowed to ask questions about the theory sufficiently far under this cutoff scale.
If you're doing it in complete generality, it's not clear that you shouldn't be adding lots of other operators as well.
Exactly. I agree. In all generality, you don't know why you don't trigger other operators from the identity conformal block, essentially, that should have stress tensor, its derivatives, products of the T bar, and so on. I will get to that. Anthony had a question.
Yeah, what do you mean by leading order in gradients? What does that mean?
So, it's basically that I could have derivatives of T or derivatives of T bar appearing in principle. That correct this factorization, that I could have derivatives of the expectation values of T, expectation values of T bar. And
specific theory, tons of other operators.
Sure. But at least here, since we're in two dimensions, and given the way various sort of modules organize themselves, if you're sitting in the identity conformal block, we expect just there to be operators, you know, involving T, T bar, and their derivative. But that's the sense in which it's leading order in gradients, that this is ultra local, right? I mean, I haven't included any derivatives of the expectation value of T or T bar. So as I was saying, we are to interpret this as a kind of regulator, as a cutoff. So what that means concretely is if we consider the theory on a cylinder, that is spatial circle times time, and ask what happened to the spectrum of the theory, the spectrum of energies. Now the energies are really, if you thought in terms of radial quantization, would be related to the spectrum of conformal dimensions associated with the dilatation operator on the plane. But for now, if we just treat them as energies, we would find that this deformation essentially leads to a deformation of the spectrum, that the energy levels get shifted in this manner. And it so happens that this deformation involves this square root, and that there is a singularity that you will reach at some value of the conformal dimension.
When mu goes to zero, it's okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
Delta n is the conformal dimension of the answer. Yeah. Oh, there's probably C over 12 being subtracted somewhere. I don't fully remember. Yes, someone should correct me about this. But yeah, that's sort of what. Yeah. So the idea here would be that you only ask about energy levels sufficiently below this special value of delta n at which you hit the square root singularity. So it's almost as though you discard all these imaginary eigenvalues you would end up seeing past this point. And in that way, this is giving you an effective cutoff on your theory. Sounds very peculiar, but later I'll show how the entanglement entropy calculation, at least at large C, is in keeping with this interpretation of modifying the cutoff in some, or modifying the spectrum in this kind of radical way. But this is the sense in which this irrelevant operator is regulating conformal field theory, or one sense at least. Now, there's this nice graph I've borrowed from this article of Miguel, Meze and Verlinde, where they essentially show what happens to the spectrum. So at zero deformation, I would just be on the y-axis, and the spectrum is just a discrete spectrum of conformal dimensions. However, as I turn on this deformation, I see that, well, these guys remain untouched. However, as you go higher, you start to notice that there's this square root singularity, and then this signals when you should declare there to be a cutoff, or there to be a cutoff theory. Okay. So as I said before, for the purposes of understanding how general relativity emerges holographically in the bulk, yeah, sure.
So you said you're declaring there to be a cutoff when the eigenvalue becomes imaginary. How do you know it's not signaling a pathology?
No, I mean, it is signaling a pathology, but if you wanted to still make sense of this as a quantum field theory, then you should be, you can only do so underneath that energy. So it's like saying that any regulator you usually use, if you try to think of the theory around the scale of the cutoff, there's something very pathological happening. You might have ghosts, as if you were using polyvalars, it'd be these very massive ghosts that but obviously that's all just a feature of the regularization. There are really no bizarre ghost states or anything of the sort. It's just that you're asking a question at the wrong scale. So it's just in that sense that I'm saying that you think of this as a cutoff, in the sense that you're not taking this theory seriously anymore at those energies.
As a QFT, it's not UV complete. You cannot go all the way to UV. There's a finite distance beyond which, you know, it's essentially as if the particles had a finite size that you cannot do beyond that size.
Right.
It makes sense as an effective theory.
Yeah, thank you. I hope that answers the question. But anyway, now, as I said before, to make the connection to the holographic normalization group, it'll help to put this theory on an arbitrary background. And this deformation equation that I was writing before becomes a generalization of the trace anomaly condition. So usually, when we want to know about the trace anomaly, we ask, how does the generating function of the conformal field theory respond under local wild transfer? And that would be the situation where mu is zero, and we would just have this term. Now, when we have the deformation, this is how it enters. And so what I'm saying is that this should be contrasted with this equation over here. But now we're using this framework of the local renormalization group. So we're thinking of the renormalization group flow equation, a local Kalman-Simoncic equation, as a statement of anomalous local Weyl invariants. Now, the fact that we had Poincaré invariants on a fixed background gets upgraded to the fact that we have background diffeomorphism invariants on this arbitrary background, as in stress tensors, one-point function remains covariantly conserved. Again, I've written this operator in this factorized form, which is a very optimistic thing to do on this general background, because Samolodchikov's proof of the factorization property held on flat space for translation invariant states, leading order and gradients, and so on. But if I were thinking about this deformation at large C, then I'm effectively in a kind of mean field regime where the correlators of posit operators that are singlets do factorize. But there's still an additional argument one would have to make to ensure that there are no gradient corrections or curvature corrections and so on that would ruin this nice form of the factorized operator. And in a moment, I will come to what's protecting that, or if the theory is holographic, why that should be protected. But there is an assumption there. Now, why this that form of the deformation is useful, or that equation defining the deformation is useful, is because there's a simple change of variables one can make, essentially, as I said, as treating this background metric as the metric induced on this finite radius boundary, and in associating to this combination of the one-point function of the stress tensor and the metric, the momentum conjugate to the metric on that constant radius surface, you turn this flow equation here into the NN component or Hamiltonian constraint of general relativity in one higher dimension. So this equation, along with this one that follows from stress tensor conservation, give us the two generators we were after of normal and tangential deformations of embedded hypersurfaces in an ambient spacetime. And as I said before, principle through Poisson brackets, you could obtain the other Einstein equations, so you recover all of the Einstein equations in the one higher dimensional bulk. Now, it mattered a lot that... Yes, go ahead, Florian.
Can you go back one slide, please?
Yeah.
This the second term, the 2 over mu g.
Yeah.
Would that also be there like in ordinary ADS CFT?
Yeah. So it's associated... Well, this is... it's related to the Bausser-Riemannian Krauss counter term that you would add in defining the holographic stress tensor. Except here it's not a counter term because there's nothing diverging, but it is what you'd need to add in order, subtract in order to turn this equation here into the expression for the Hamiltonian constraint. This was first discovered by Miko and Nese and Verlinde in this article in late 2016. However,
does it match the identification you get from looking at Federovitch?
I'm sorry?
Does it match what you get if you just start from the full solution of Federovitch?
So...
Is there you have the normal equation? I mean, there's the other picture, right? Instead of starting from the bottom, you start from gravity, and then you push it to infinity.
Right.
So there, like you have the completion of it. So does that function? And there is a what is the deformation, but below the linear order.
Right. Well, the work that you're referring to, variables are slightly different. I don't really know what the holographic stress tensor, as in what this counter term would exactly look like, but I suspect that it would mismatch. Just, I mean, we can talk later about why I think so, but for now I'll say tentatively yes. But as I was saying before, it mattered that this factorization property held for this mapping between variables to result in this nice result that obtained the Einstein equations in one higher dimension. It really mattered that this factorization property even held on this curved background. And generally, I don't understand why that should happen. However, at least if the theory ought to be holographic, then the bulk equations of motion must be diffeomorphism invariant. So diffeomorphism invariance of the one higher dimensional space-time must sort of emerge. And that leads to a very specific condition on this local renormalization group flow, kind of integrability condition, if you'd like, that if I took the commutator of two generators of such transformations, that they must satisfy this relation, that they should be related to the diffeomorphism ordered entity and hence vanish. So this is a very special form of what is known as the holographic, what is known as the Wess-Immino consistency conditions or the Weil consistency conditions, but sort of specialized to the case of holographic theories. So if this condition is satisfied by R sub sigma, then that implies that we must really have this form of the factorized one-point function of the TT bar operator, even on an arbitrary background. So this assumption of this of the protection of factorization property really is an assumption about the emergence of one higher dimensional diffeomorphism invariant. So it's sort of pushing one hope to another, but at least there's a geometrical interpretation for what this is. And so this is kind of the dual statement of 2 plus 1 dimensional diffeomorphism invariance in the emergent bulk theory. Geometric.
Question. So you said the central charge to be large.
Yeah.
How does that play with the cutoff that you have in the UV theory? So that graph you showed us. How does that?
You'll still have a cutoff in these energies in principle. So the large central charge limit, if we're concentrating on the stress tensor sector of the theory, is really like the classical limit of the theory, because the prefactor of, in a conformal field theory, the prefactor of the anomaly action, which you would differentiate to obtain the stress tensor, is just C. So the large C limit is kind of like the zero H bar limit. So you'd have to rescale one-point functions in a slightly careful way to make sense of what you mean by E when you actually identify it. And then, but nonetheless, I still think that the cutoff still remains. And moreover, I'll show later that there's an entanglement entropy calculation that confirms this intuition that there is indeed a kind of modification of the ultraviolet behavior of this theory, even at large C, sort of in keeping with this interpretation of there being a cutoff.
So what are the parameters? To LG and then?
RC? RC is the radius of the surface, of this cutoff surface, essentially. So when RC goes to infinity, you're at infinity, the asymptotic boundary.
So RC is bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure, no, but here you need to be able to extrapolate to finite mu. It's not just I agree.
In some sense, it has nothing to do with large C. It has to do with large R.
Yeah, essentially...
Large C doesn't a priori...
Yeah.
Large C fixes R.
Right. Or you could also think of it as small g. I mean, that you're being semi-classical with... gravity, and this is usually how people think about small g, or GL.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So,
but c times mu is fixed.
Yeah, c times mu has to be held, or the square root or something like that has to be held fixed. So, as I was saying before, this.
Sorry, from the RG, what is c times mu? Because from the RG, you only had.
Yeah, but there's C in the anomaly term, and then you'd have to multiply things, as I said, rescale things appropriately when you actually take the equals to infinity limit.
What is it?
Nothing. I think that. I think that taking C to infinity consistently would require holding C times mu fixed, sending mu to zero, but it's kind of like the large n limit, large n gauge theories. you can make sense of, even in the planar limit, in leading order in N, a whole quantum field theory of the Toft coupling. So you think of root mu c as analogous to the Toft coupling, the lambda there. And then that's sort of what's playing a role in this, as a coupling constant is playing a role in the IG. So as I said before, this statement of emergent diffeomorphism invariance essentially comes from this kind of basically asking what's the commutator of two separate normal deformations, and it has to be tangential. That's why this funny condition reflects the emergent covariance of the theory. So in short, we have the space of, say, all theories, the large N or C of just the stress tensor, as ensourced only by the metric. Then there's the consistent theories, where we have the Westermann consistency condition being satisfied. And then there's the theories that are dual to GR that have this condition be satisfied in a very particular manner. It's just a mnemonic to keep in mind. So as I said before, it's possible to generalize some of this to four dimensions and also include a matter field in the bulk corresponding to
dual to GR.
As in, So again, the fact that I'm at large C means that the dual theory is classical. And well, I mean, basically by saying that I do this transformation of variables to go from
at large Toft coupling, quantum field theory is still a quantum.
Right, but the dual theory is classical gravity.
The quantum theory then makes sense for all values of the.
Yeah. So if I would have to move in the Toft coupling, I would. Staying at large n, I would. Again, the boundary theory remains quantum, but in the bulk, I'd start to introduce string states, so on. So large n is sort of playing the role of 1 over h bar in the bulk. Or, yeah, 1 over h bar in the bulk.
Guess I just don't know if I can quantize such a
general. I'm sorry?
Guess I just don't know if I can quantize such a general gravity theory.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I don't know either. But again, I should just said that I was only out to try to understand how the classical theory emerges in the bulk. The questions of quantization are all left to future work. Okay, so again, if we take a large N four-dimensional holographic theory, then we can introduce similar deforming operators, sort of composite quadratic operator of the stress tensor, and a double trace scalar deformation. And there are one-point functions factorized now due to the large N property. And this deformation equation I was writing before, the local renormalization group equation, now generalizes as follows. Notice that there's this beta function even for the metric coupling, which either looks alien or natural depending on your perspective. But the right-hand side is identical. So when I set the deformation parameters to zero, this is just a statement of the Weyl anomaly. So this, and I need A equals C because the theory I'm deforming is holographic, and that's one of the holographic in the sense that it's dual to general relativity, and that's one of the constraints on it. Now, what will happen is if I would want to do the change of variables to turn that flow equation into the expression for the normal component of the Einstein equation in one higher dimension, I would require these beta functions to have this gradient form, where this potential driving this gradient flow is in form identical to the two derivative quantum effective action derived, say, by, I think it was, Nitti and others. But it'll also play a role in relating the one-point function of the energy momentum tensor and this deforming scalar operator to the momenta conjugate to these to their sources. And I would also require kappa to be equal to mu. And I, again, obtain a flow equation. But
here you write down the Zamolodchikov's form for flow equation. So you're saying you want to write the Zamolodchikov metric.
this kind of.
So you just need to find the operator that has the right 1/3 factor instead of an arbitrary.
Right. Well, you could even derive these. You could even derive the result of this, that these functions have to take this particular gradient form from that integrability condition I was talking about before. That the only way to satisfy that.
But what's not universal is the shape of the Zabotnik.
Yeah. Yeah.
So naively you would have an arbitrary.
Right.
So let's say naively you get an Ojava.
Yeah. Yeah.
So from the algebra flow, what distinguish usual graph Ojava?
This is precisely what this specific form of the conditions are doing for you. So in general, this is just a definition of a consistent theory. However, if I want the representation of the Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra on the RG, then I need this to be satisfied because of the diffeomorphism word identity. So it's this kind of this is more than that. This is the statement of how the space-time diffeomorphism invariance emerges. So that's what makes it non-trivial.
Ojava breaks that. So
Ojava won't break that. So what would happen in Ojava is that you wouldn't be allowed to have this be an arbitrary function of space. It would have to be a fixed, like, sort of constant function on space. It couldn't be, like, the sigma couldn't be an arbitrary function. It really has to be fixed, constant over space. And that's the only way you would satisfy this condition. It's basically like saying that in Ojava gravity, you're fixing an infinite number of first-class constraints except for one along the time direction or radial direction situation. This... Now I'll move over to holographic entanglement entropy. Reasons to study it really are to get better understanding of this regularization feature that we were talking about before. Now, why it's interesting from the bulk perspective is it probes bulk geometry. So the holographic entanglement entropy conjectures relate the von Neumann entanglement entropy of the conformal associated to a region in the conformal field theory on the boundary to the area of a minimal surface anchored to the entangling surface on the boundary. So this minimal surface probes the bulk, but entanglement entropy itself is sensitive to the UV properties of the quantum field theory. There's a UV divergence there. And we would like to understand what the effect of this TT bar deformation is on said UV properties, but also we would like to see if there's a generalization of this holographic entanglement entropy conjecture to the situation where boundary is at finite radius. So I'll just sketch the strategy for how the computation on the field theory side actually goes. We use this, again, we're going back to two dimensions now, where in the three-dimensional bulk, the minimal surface I was referring to is just a geodesic. Now, we use this flow equation that I was mentioning before. And again, at large C, we have this factorization property and everything. And we essentially treat the conservation equation and this relation as equations to determine the stress tensor component. Then, having obtained set stress tensor components, we can, through this relation, obtain the partition function on a replicated geometry. So, use a replica trick, which essentially involves gluing sort of this infinite copies of space identified along the entangling surface, or at the entangling surface. The space of our choice will be a sphere, so the replicated geometry is a branch cover of the sphere. And we obtain the entanglement entropy. I'm sorry, this is a bad notation. R here is no longer the radial coordinate in the bulk. It's really the radius of this sphere. And the boundary is taken to be a sphere. That's the geometry on which this field theory lives. And this R is just this.
No,
we're really on a sphere now. And then this R is now the radius of that sphere. Fortunately, N is the replica number. So on this branch cover. And we obtain the von Neumann entropy in this funny limit. So it involves this analytic continuation in N, taking it to 1. And what we find at the end of the day is this result, which is that we have an inverse hyperbolic sine of the radius measured in units of the square root of mu times c. So this confirms the intuition that the square root of mu times c is sort of playing the, mu at least is playing the role of cutoff scale. And just to remind everyone, in a conformal field theory, we'd have the logarithm of r measured in units of a cutoff, spatial cutoff. And what we can do is make the identifications of parameters that I'd shown before many slides ago here. And then see what this result becomes in the bulk. And what we find is that indeed, if we were to take the appropriate geodesic running between the boundary points corresponding to the entangling surface, so this circle is really the sphere I was referring to before, I have to suppress one dimension. So again, I take a time slice, and this great semicircle is the region I'm tracing out. So the entangling surface is really these two points. And what it so happens is that the inverse cinch here, making all the identifications I was mentioning before, is exactly what you'd get from the length of a geodesic running between these two points on the boundary. So it appears as though the holographic entanglement entropy conjecture of Ryu and Takayanagi persists in the finite radius setting. Moreover, we can also obtain conical entropies, which are strange relatives of the Reni entropy, but you can think of them as essentially the entropy of an ensemble whose energy is given by the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian at temperature 1 over n. And there's a conjecture dual to this quantity in the bulk. This conjecture is due to Shidong. And now, instead of having a minimal surface, you have a brain with some tension that, again, is anchored to the entangling surface on the boundary. And it back reacts to create a conical deficit, certain opening angle. And this property, just like this quantity, just like the Reni entropy, limits to the entanglement entropy as n goes to 1. And from a similar exercise as we did for the von Neumann entropy, now we just don't take the limit. What we find, again, for more details, please see the paper I wrote with Will. We find this complete elliptic integral of the third kind, and it's just more illuminating to look at it as a function of R or N. And it so happens that the easiest way to do this calculation, preserving both the symmetry around the entangling surface and the reality of the stress tensor, is not to analytically continue from n greater than 1, but to do so from n less than 1, and then analytically continue the answer we get past n equals 1. And so you see that, like the von Neumann entropy, at r equals 0, all of these entropies vanish. And again, sort of grow with r. And this is what they look like as a function of n. They're decreasing. But as I said, and it's like the inverse temperature. So it's like saying that the entropy grows with the increase of temperature. So we also find that, like the holographic entanglement, the von Neumann entropy conjecture, Shidong's holographic conical entropy conjecture also holds at finite radius. And instead of looking at grains with certain tension in the bulk, thanks to the symmetry of the problem we have, we can rescale the angle such that we now move this conical deficit that was in the bulk to the boundary. And we have just an embedding of these footballs, so to speak, in the ambient anti-de Sitter space. And here's a few of them, again, as a function of n. And as n increases from 0 to 1, they become ever less football-like. And again, at n equals 1, you go back to having this this sphere and the geodesic sort of running between the two endpoints. Okay, so it's a comment here that this property that the short distance divergence of the entanglement entropy is now just alleviated or just completely removed, and that the entanglement entropy really goes to zero at r equals zero, is reminiscent of what the CMER would have us do, which is to append to the ultraviolet of the CFT a kind of trivial theory. Theory with zero entanglement, zero partition functions, basically completely gapped. And just to visualize the difference between what we have and what you would have in a conformal field theory, just plotted the two kinds of entanglement, two formulae for the entanglement entropy. The yellow curve is what we have versus the blue one, which is what would happen with the entanglement entropy, which is diverge to minus infinity as you get closer and closer to r equals zero. I don't really know what more to make of that connection, except that there's this feature that they have in common that looks like there's a trivial theory in the ultraviolet moving into this conformal field theory in the infrared.
Ultraviolet doesn't exist, right?
One way of saying is that it doesn't exist, but again, it's really analogous to throwing away those imaginary eigenvalues on the cylinder. So all I'm trying to do is read into what this what studying the entanglement properties at large C are telling me. So
but there's no degrees of freedom left.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, zero entanglement.
Yeah, so that's the sense in which I mean that it's kind of trivial, that it, for distance, is just nothing there. And, you could ask, what does it mean to talk about this zeroth Reni entropy? And, well, as I was saying before, you have this interpretation of these conical entropies as entropy in an ensemble where the energy is given by the modular Hamiltonian. Well, this zeroth one is really the kind of the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space that you'd be on. And so it really looks like you have this kind of finite dimensional system, as in finite dimensional Hilbert space associated to some kind of quantum mechanical system. It's almost as though you're using this field theory is a redundant way of talking about just this simple system. But again, I don't really know how to make any more sense of this. But that brings me to conclusions, which are that it looks like it's possible to identify the right operator deformations that trigger flows which are due to radial development in the bulk along the radial direction. And for at least one of these theories, we see that the ultraviolet properties that entanglement measures suggest reflect the regularization property that you would want a cutoff prescription to have. Now, as I said before, I don't know what any of this means away from the large N or C limit, and this is related to the question about quantization, which, again, is related to quantum gravity in finite regions, which I won't venture to guess what it will look like. And also, there's this perspective about this DT bar deformation that you can see it as arising from coupling the conformal field theory to a certain topological gravity theory. So that there's also a kind of dynamical gravity on the boundary. Maybe this can help make sense of what's going on around this cutoff scale and so on. So it's all left for future work. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk, and we finished that up, and despite those many questions, so we still have time for more questions.
So this TG bar deformation, can I view it as giving a Lorentz invariant regulator to the entropy?
Yeah.
And so you could prove, like, rigorously things like Strong-Sub additivity with this with as your regulator? Because I thought that was subtle thing with these proofs is that all those things in the, that show up in those inequalities are infinite.
Hmm. Well, that's a good question. I haven't thought about that. But that would be something worth trying.
Yeah, but it always comes back to whether or not such a Lorentz invariant regulator exists for the entropy. So you'd say, yeah, this is Tall's.
Well, there's a subtlety because with CFDs, people have these entropic proofs of things like the C theorem, right? Which essentially follow from strong subadditivity. But here, you have this peculiar irrelevant flow, which sort of should run you afoul of C theorem in a weird way. So I don't really know if that reflects badly on strong subadditivity. I mean, this is an interesting question. I just don't know what the answer is. But yeah, I can only respond with another question. Unfortunately.
Sometimes those variations of this TG bar deformation give rise to a sensible string geometry. The work of, Aroni et al.
Kutuzov, yeah.
And maybe other people I should be quoting. It's the first name that comes back. So it's a Levi-Schwarz fibre. Really, that's the UV completion. Flow down. ADS free geometry with this TT bar effect. So it's kind of funny that somehow, next question, that there should be some variations of what you're doing that are going to be different, that are not going to be trivial in the UD.
Right.
Sometimes you get a UD theory, which is the one living on the Levi-Schwarz fibre. And so
there's this.
See, so, how it is that debates this general.
So you should be careful here because the work of Kutuzov, Aroni, and others on this little string theory dual at finite radius, they call it TT bar, but it's not really TT bar. It's different. It's a single trace deformation that is also irrelevant and has some of the features that TT bar does, but it's not quite the one that Mekko, Verlinde, and Meze used in their work. But I agree that it is important to understand.
So what I'm saying is there's another class of
deformations
which are really going away from the near horizon limit.
Yeah.
Right. Which seems to capture more interesting physics.
Right. That's true. That's true. Indeed.
Whether you could generalize that to just abstract gravity question.
Right. Right. That's a good question. I just haven't thought about it yet. But another thing along similar lines is this deformation in four dimensions that I was mentioning. It would just be nice to see what happens if one includes also the BPS sector or something. So if you take the stress tensor and BPS sector of n equals 4 and really see, I mean, that might be a little bit more concrete way of seeing whether there's this joint flow can somehow reveal some features of, again, this away from near horizon limit or something like that, but again, all work yet to be done.
Along the same line, there is a known completion of this system, which is pure 3D gravity. So we know what quantize, it's finite, and we know its UV completion. And so, and from that 3D gravity, you can go the other way. You can show that you induce the CFT in the boundary. So I don't understand why the first focus would not be. I understand this is just a subclass, but this one is perfectly consistent on itself. You don't need extra supersymmetry or whatever. It's fully consistent, and a priori there's a very well-defined proposal for what is full completion.
So this
given that, you know, really barely exists on its own and satisfies the by when first do that. And I mean, do you know the exact proposal for what is the mapping between the so it would be nice.
I agree. I mean, this is related to this.
This one is the first.
Sure. So this is related to this proposal by Dubovsky and others that there's this sort of topological gravity theory even on the boundary. That's really, it rhymes with the idea of having this theory of boundary gravitons or something on the finite radius boundary. And in principle, you can do this even away from large C. And
just not Jacob-Teteborn, like real bona fide Einstein gravity.
No, it's Einstein gravity in 3D. This is Jacob-Teteborn gravity on the boundary, in 2D.
Oh.
So it's as though you're coupling. So it's as though you're coupling this CFT to this Jacob-Teteborn theory. But since this is also gravitational, I don't know, like the gravity-gravity duality might be easier to understand. And then this might just connect to this intuition that I just took the radial solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in 3D, however I'd like to construct it. Could I discover that, well, there's in fact Jacob-Teteborn gravity coupled to some CFT that's playing, that you can compute this solution with. So that would be a way of setting this up.
Because I found this property, very the 3D gravity.
Yeah, so there's
your TT bar in some sense completes itself. If that's true,
yeah.
It would be nice to see how it does.
Yeah, so that would be relaxing the large C limit, essentially.
What?
The large C limit.
Yeah, because
So
really?
I agree that that's definitely a easier direction maybe to go down.
Any further questions or comments? In that case, let's think about it, okay?